Okay, here we go. Stand by. 3, 2, 1.
The Thinking Atheist. It's not a person. It's a symbol. An idea.
The population of atheists in this country is going through the roof.
Rejecting faith. Pursuing knowledge. Challenging the sacred.
If I tell the truth, it's because I tell the truth. Not because I put my hand on a book and made a wish.
And working together for a more rational world.
Take the risk of thinking for yourself. Much more happiness, truth, beauty, and wisdom will come to you that way.
Assume nothing. Question everything. And start thinking. This is the Thinking Atheist Podcast, hosted by Seth Andrews.
When I was a devout Christian, if you'd called me an animal, I'd have probably been insulted. How dare you compare me with those hairy brutes, if it's a primate, you know, those knuckle-dragging brutes. It was uncivilized creatures. And I would have especially laughed out loud if somebody had told me that I had a relationship to all living things. The fish, you know, the house plant. I'd have been like, what are you talking about? And of course, for the last dozen years, as somebody who has emerged from the creationist cocoon, I've become fascinated by my own relationship to all living things. And the conversations I've been privileged to have, and I'm going to share one with you on the show today. I mean, it just, you hear about it, you learn about it, you discover more about it. Our relationship with the living world, our existence as higher primates, it's awesome. It is so much fun to learn this stuff. It doesn't rob me of anything. It doesn't cheat my life. In fact, in a whole lot of ways, it makes me more thankful to be alive. So what I'm going to play for you today is a 30-minute conversation I had with a primatologist. I met her in Austin, Texas last fall. Her name is Erica. She goes by the Reddit and YouTube handle Gutsick Gibbon, and she explains the definition of that. One of the most compelling and enjoyable conversations, discussions I have had on this subject, I think, with anybody. And I've had a lot of them and great ones, but Erica just lit me up like a Christmas tree. The way she was able to articulate and put all this stuff together and explain from her position as an expert, I mean, someone who really does play in this sandbox and is an educator on primatology and zoology, the evolved human being. Anyway, there's a YouTube link in the description box. I encourage you, after you're done listening to the audio podcast version, and it makes for a great audio podcast, but after you're done, when you get the time, go back and click the YouTube link and watch. Because as she's giving this rapid-fire series of examples, and there are a ton of examples, you know, from the dinosaurs to the whales to the dolphin to our relationship with other primates, showing stuff like, you know, brain casing and skull size and charts and stuff like that. That's something, of course, that you can't see here, but it really is fascinating in visual form. So that YouTube link is in the description box of the broadcast. But sit back and enjoy a half an hour as we talk about the human primate with Erica, also known online as Gutsick Gibbon. Enjoy. Erica, you run a YouTube channel that is called what?
It is called Gutsick Gibbon.
I need more. Like, I need an explanation. What is Gutsick?
It's, you know, I get asked this question about as often as you would think. And unfortunately, no one is ever satisfied with the answer because it's not that funny. But I cartoon. I do cartoons and animations in a lot of my videos. And I had drawn this sickly looking little gibbon, right, around the time that I decided I was going to get in fights with people on the Debate Evolution subreddit. So I titled my account there Gutsick Gibbon because it's a gibbon and it's sick to its guts, I guess. That it sounded really good in my head, but I was like, it's a Reddit account. It's not going to be forever, right?
Well, I have a confession to make. I hadn't been introduced to you until we met at the Faithless Forum event.
Ah.
And I saw you on a panel, and I was like, not only are you very knowledgeable on the subject that we're about to speak about, but you have an unbridled enthusiasm, like a contagious enthusiasm. And I take that as a compliment, right?
I certainly do. It's hard not to be. It's so mind-bogglingly incredible.
Okay, now hang on. I've got to interrupt you. Your area of expertise, your focus is what?
I am, by training, technically a primatologist, and looking to further that with my current PhD program in biological anthropology, so specifically the study of human evolution. Think the folks who go out and find hominins, like Lucy or Homo erectus or Neanderthals, things like that. But my classical training that is completed as of right now is living primates. So I love human evolution, and I love the evolution of our entire order.
You know, I'm not a monkey. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm a created being. I mean, there are humans and there are animals.
Of course, very different.
Yeah.
Yes, very different. All right,
someone comes to you and they say, my grandfather wasn't a monkey, I'm not a chimpanzee. You know, they come out with the tired, hackneyed arguments against evolution or shared ancestry with our primate ancestors, you know?
Yes.
Am I still a monkey? You know, am I a monkey?
You are indeed, yes. It's incredible to really go through the entire chain. So I'll be briefer than I've been in the past. Most people who are evangelicals will generally accept that humans are mammals, and then they'll be like, but we're not animals, right? Because it's very hard to deny being a mammal. It's like, you know, we are covered in hair. Females of our species, of our group, produce milk. We're endothermic. We've got these dental squamosal joints, although they don't tend to bring that one up. It's a less popular diagnostic trait. But they tend to draw the line at primates. And I've never understood that, because I think that there is, as Darwin said, you know, beauty and grandeur in this view of life. But you are definitively and objectively, not only are you a primate, but you are also a haplorine primate. You are a catarrhine primate, right? You are a hominoid, and you're a hominid, and you're a member of the genus Homo, and your species is Homo sapiens. All of the traits that categorize each of those groups, you have now. And whether or not you include humans in the categorization of life, those categories don't change. So there has been an accusation from some evangelicals that the evolutionists are trying to force humans into this category. The taxonomy that we work with today was invented, if you will, conceived by Carl Linnaeus, this guy who lived a long time ago, right? And he was a creationist. And when he was faced with where to put humans on the tree of life, he, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he has this famous quote where he says, I would bring down, you know, the ire of all the theologians, if I were to say this, but I can think of no reason by which to separate man from simian and simian from man. And he said this when he got to, you know, get a gander at not only a human skeleton, but the skeletons of these other apes, right? We are what they are, and everything that is unique morphologically or physically about us, it's just a tweak on an already existing structure. We exist on a gradient with the rest of these incredible animals. And there are, of course, things that humans do that are unique, but they are a product of smaller changes that exist in us physically.
So the, you know, the hair on our arms and legs and, you know, chest, et cetera, this is a holdover from my primate relatives, yeah?
It certainly is. In fact, you have the same number of follicles on your body as a chimpanzee does. Our hair is just finer. I'm female, but I still have hair on my face. It's just very fine. You can't see it. And like chimps, the only place that we don't have hair is the palms of our hands and the soles of our feet. We are, grossly enough, primarily different from them in that we are sweaters. We are sweaty apes. The reason that it's proposed that our hair went by the wayside is for thermoregulation running on the open savannas, right? So we have three times the eccrine glands or the sweat glands than a chimpanzee does, which makes sense. They're hairier than us, and we lost most of the hair, at least in its coarseness, right? It's still there, you just can't see it as well. And we are just incredible runners and sweaters, and this is thought by some to be a driver of human evolution, the ability to run for long periods of time, a tradition that's held by hunter-gatherers that live in Africa to this day. which is incredible.
So, I mean, what are some other examples of, you know, the evidences of my relation? I mean, I've heard wisdom teeth have to come out because our jaws used to be larger. Is that true?
Yes. Interestingly enough, though, if as a human, there's a complicated aspect of kind of this phenotypic plasticity that goes along with that. If you eat hard foods as a child, you actually are less likely to have your wisdom teeth, you know, being required to be removed, which is why most people who live in sort of quote unquote less developed nations, they don't tend to have as many teeth problems. They eat harder foods and they eat less sugar. So the it's not like we've degraded and that's why, you know, we have to get our wisdom teeth out. We just don't eat hard enough stuff when we're young. But your apish heirlooms are all over your body. You're covered in hair, of course. You have the same dental pattern as a chimpanzee does. 2-1-2-3, 2 incisors, a single canine, 2 premolars and 3 molars, right? You have the same number of rods and cones in your eyes and your brain is organized in exactly the same way. We have all of the same bones as they do. Again, they're just tweaked and moved in some slightly different directions. And we have all the same muscles. We have more slow twitch muscles than fast twitch, right? Because we're dexterous. We're the best throwers in the animal kingdom. Of course, we sacrificed our strength for that. A chimpanzee is 3 times the strength of a human, and a gorilla is 5, an adult male human. But they can't throw, you know, for Jack. They're horrible throwers. They lob things up and over. We have fingernails, just like they do, just like all primates do, instead of claws at the ends of our fingers. And why is that? It's because when you grab a branch, you don't want to bring those nails into your palm. So we just flattened out the keratin in order to still get the utility, but be able to move through the trees. We have mobile shoulder joints. There's no reason, quote unquote, for a human to be able to raise their arms up like this over their heads. Right? But we descend from critters that lived in the trees for whom this was a really necessary morphologic characteristic. It's all over us. I mean, we share 98.8% of our coding DNA with chimpanzees, and they share more with us. This always blew my mind. They share more with us genetically than they do with a gorilla. So not only are they our closest living relative, but we're their closest living relative as well. It's inescapable. We have endogenous retroviruses located in the exact same place all across our genome, right? And many of the same breakages. Of course, there are novelties to the human genome, and there are novelties to the chimp genome as well. We are special, but so are they. So is every creature in its own way.
You follow the work of Neil Shubin, I'm guessing.
I do. Yeah, I just talked about Neil earlier today.
Your inner fish. That's counterintuitive. When I was a belief, I was like, oh, come on, that's just bullshit. There's just no way, right? I mean, I know that we have a commonality with all living things, including plant life. I would have totally rejected that, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm related to a fish, and, you know, he had an example, I think, in his television version where they showed someone who had, I guess I call it a gill. What would you call that?
Pharyngeal gill slits. So it's fascinating to think about, but much of our face, including our inner ear bones, right? So your malleus, your incus, and your stapes that allow you to hear the way that you do. In utero, they come from these primitive structures that in a fetus, in an embryo of the same age in a fish, become their gill arches, right? So it's ontogeny recapitulating evolution. Right? In the same way, and I think this is very fascinating too, obviously we have tails in the womb. And when you don't properly terminate that tail, it can stick around and people can be born with tails. In dolphins and whales, so cetaceans, for a very brief period, I think it's about 2 weeks, they have little hind limb buds that grow and then they terminate and they reabsorb back into the body. Why would they do that if they didn't have an ancestor that was terrestrial? And in the fossil record, there's a critter called Indohyus, who's this little hoofed mammal that ran along the coastlines where we find it, in these ancient coastlines. It's got this little structure in its ear called the involucrum. And every modern whale and dolphin has it, and no other animal we know of does. This is a unique structure that's been carried through the lineage of these creatures in the same way that we carry our ape heirlooms and our monkey heirlooms and our, you know, Omamiid heirlooms all the way down to present. We all carry the what Darwin says, the stamp of our lowly origin. But I think it's a lot more incredible than that.
You engage intelligent designers, creationists. I mean, they're not always the same thing, but I mean, you know, I understand how they have maneuvered away from creationism with a capital C into ID.
Oh, yes.
To try to remain relevant. Teach the controversy kind of stuff. Do you, you know, I think it was Stephen Jay Gould who said that religion and science are non-overlapping magisteria. I mean, I don't know, can religion and science play together from your perspective?
There are folks that disagree with me on this. I know many excellent scientists who are religious.
Francis Collins, right?
Of
the Human Genome Project,
yeah.
Who is a proponent of evolution.
Oh, yes, yeah. And in the Kitzmiller versus Dover trial, if memory serves, or at least a consultant for it. A great many of our scientists, from paleontologists to geneticists to evolutionary biologists, are people of faith. I don't think there necessarily has to be a clash there. I think the danger shows up when you go back far enough in time, and eventually there is going to be a concession, at least on the side of the religious individual, who's going to say, okay, well, it had to be fine-tuned. Either the conditions for life to emerge in an abiogenetic fashion, or a finger touching on the water, right, to spark life in the first place, guided evolution, perhaps. And from my perspective as someone who is involved with science, so long as you accept the principles and the methodologies of science and you do good science yourself, I frankly don't care where you think the motivation comes from. But I will be considerably more suspicious of folks who are quite open about that, just because at some level they're starting with the conclusion first and working backwards. And that's a dangerous game to play. So I think there can be excellent religious scientists. I know many of them myself. But I think that, I hope that they are particularly wary and on their guard in order to keep these magisteria, as you say, from overlapping and one from impeding the other. And if they're religious, we know which one's going to win out.
So you're engaged with a creationist? I mean, come on, which one really cooks your noodle? Which argument or proof do you hear and part of you dies inside? Or maybe than one.
I mean, for me, so because I do human evolution, right, the biggest one that gets me is there are no transitional fossils. That's the one that kills me. And they'll look at the hominins, the 21-plus hominins that we have, and they'll say, well, they can all be categorized as either human or ape, which is hysterical because that's like saying that all of a dog lineage can be categorized as dog or canine, right? It's like they are canines in the same way that we are apes. But the lineage of humans, of hominins, going backwards in time, is so ridiculously smooth that on my trip to the Creation Museum recently, I noticed that they just frankly omitted several of them because they couldn't fit them into a box. Australopithecus sediba and Homo habilis and Homo rudolfensis, three hominins that have an intermediate brain case size between a human and this ancient, you know, common ancestor between humans and chimps, but are definitively bipedal. So it's a creature that's walking upright on two feet. This bipedality emerges very early and with Ardipithecus ramidus. And then they've got this intermediate brain case size of approximately 500 to 700 cubic centimeters. So what do you do with that if you're a creationist? How do you cope with God creating an organism that is a perfect intermediate, as perfect as someone who is interested in evolutionary biology and paleontology could ever ask for? How do you cope with that? Where does it fall? And as I've mentioned before here at the forum, the response to this is generally either ignoring it or something just outrageous, like saying, well, those transitional species are a mix of human and ape bones, actually, and they just look really transitional. Okay, how about the transitional aspects of the skull, where it's moderately prognathic, like a chimp with a little bit of a muzzle, and it's got a medium brain case size? That's not like a mixed bone. You can't mix two craniums together, right? And that's to say nothing of some of the specimens that are in articulation, where we'll find, you know, they'll be like, well, the hands are too human, so those are from the human, but the arm is actually from an ape because it's very primitive. Oh, interesting. How come they articulate together like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle? Why were they found in articulation as if you would find a modern forensic scene, a skeleton that's still, you know, connected with its bits, effectively? And then at that point, they'll usually just change the subject.
The Creation Museum, I mean, you made it all the way through without putting your head through one of the dinosaur displays.
They have a real dinosaur, a real Allosaurus specimen there. It kills me. That Allosaurus's ghost is probably like just writhing in agony of where it's being placed. It's like, all the places, really here? It's a lot.
Did you do anything on it on your channel or, you know, have you profiled?
I do. It's actually my best performing video. It's got 150,000 views right now. It's my documentary, my opus, right? My summer project. And I went through the Creation Museum and I took as many pictures and as much video as I could. And I did a long, detailed, well-sourced takedown of the science behind it, or lack thereof. Of course, the greatest hits are pretending that the speed of light can be changed that the speed of light is variable to the degree that you can cram, you know, 13 billion years of the universe's history into 6,000 years. That's excellent. That radiometric dating doesn't work. Of course, I guess they're unaware that the entire energy industry relies on radiometric dating working to fuel our economy globally, right? You have to base and model in order to figure out where to drill for oil. That's done with radiometric dating.
Isn't that argument based on the fact they're using the wrong methods to date? Oh, dinosaurs and carbon-14, you don't use carbon-14 on dinosaurs, right?
Yeah, you can't carbon-14 date anything that is older than the range changes as our technology gets better, right? Because you can actually detect more minute amounts of carbon. But the general range tends to be 50,000 to 80,000 years, and 80,000 is really pushing it. Like, if you get a 50,000-year date, it's almost definitely contamination, right? Because there's carbon in the atmosphere, and it can contaminate a lot of this material and give you these really oddball readings. Also, water carries carbon with it, too. So if your bone's been exposed to any kind of fluvial deposit, it's going to be contaminated, right? Which is why no one carbon dates these things. No one in their right mind carbon dates them. And it's hilarious to me because these same people who are saying carbon dating is bunk, it's bad, it doesn't work, then they won't touch argon-argon dating, which of course is what's used for a lot of this basin modeling because it's too scary and too mean to their worldview. But they will try to dunk on carbon dating, and in the same breath, they will turn around and use it to validate the dating of the Dead Sea Scrolls to support biblical chronology. And you can't do that, right? They will provide absolutely no line, no methodology for saying, here's where carbon dating breaks down. Here's where it doesn't work anymore. They just go, no, it stops working at like 5,000 years, 6,000 usually. And they do the same thing with genetics, right? The Creation Museum was bad about this, but my debate with Kent Hovind was particularly grating. So we use paternity tests, right? They're admissible in court. That's how good they are, right? We compare these highly variable regions of the genome to tell who is the father, right? To figure out who's related to who. The technology that we use for paternity tests is a dumbed down version of comparative genomics between species, right? So in comparative genomics, we take the full genome of an organism and we compare it with the full genome of another organism, and we run statistical tests to see how likely it is that these relationships could be by chance, or if perhaps, well, I don't know, they're related. As I said earlier, you know, humans and chimps are 98.8% identical on their coding base pairs, 96 when you include non-coding regions. And so I ask creationists often, where does inheritance of genetics stop working, right? You accept that paternity tests work. You accept comparative genomics to say that lions and tigers are related, right? Lions and tigers are 95% similar on their coding base pairs. Humans and chimps, 3.8 times more than that. So why does it break down for you there? And they never have an answer. I've never heard a convincing answer for that. Kent Hovind obfuscated the question 3 times and then started talking about The Green Mile, the movie. And I was like, great.
Yeah, yeah. Kent Hovind, I get the vibe. He's on a quest for relevance these days. I know a lot of people, you know, he used to target young children, right? And he gets them to distrust. He teaches them the caricature of evolution. I was one of those kids, right? I didn't know anything about it. I just knew it was wrong. Mm. And it threatened my specialness. You know, I was created. My father is a cosmic wizard. I'm anointed and adopted by a divine king, and I'm on a quest for Jesus kind of thing. You know, this idea that I was a lowly animal. And it's funny, on the other side of that, and I'm reminded of this, I'm sure you've seen it. You probably shared it. where they show the human fingers with the fingerprints and the primate fingerprints. I don't know if it was a gorilla or something, and you see the nuances. You see how alike we are.
Oh yeah.
And I was struck by how amazing it was. I wasn't threatened by it. I was actually like, it's amazing, right?
Our closest living relatives today are capable than far more than the average person tends to give them credit for. They have politics, these linear hierarchies that are maintained by coalitions where they team up with one another to literally overthrow their current leader, right? In chimpanzees that are patriarchal and warlike, and you know, these male groups will patrol, and when they find strange males, they'll kill him in the most gruesome ways possible. And at the same time, they will care for one another and mourn and comfort when a female loses her child, when her offspring dies. Everyone in the troop mourns. Bonobos are by contrast highly matriarchal. They're run by an old female. And the females use these same coalitions that the males use to get what they want and basically lord it over the males who aren't as close to one another. This is very reminiscent of societies that we see today, coalitions among social groups, along kin lines that you use to make yourself feel more powerful and get what you want. But at the same time, they're impeccably empathetic. They laugh when they're tickled, just like a human child does, right? They have these complicated relationships through generations where they recognize family even when they've been separated for a while. Right? They're capable of tool use to the degree where female chimpanzees, because they tend to not, when they hunt, they tend not to hunt in groups like the males do, although they can. They'll sharpen sticks with their teeth and use them to skewer bush babies that they can't reach with their hands. They're intelligent enough to know that. Mothers teach their babies how to use their favorite types of rocks for tools, to crack open nuts. Right? They recognize caretakers, human caretakers, after decades of being separated. They have the same familiarity that we do with one another. So politics, mourning, empathy, it's all there, all the things that we do. And of course, yes, we look very similar. If you've seen videos of them standing up and walking on 2 feet, right? They tend to be bipedal when they go in the water. They hold their little arms up and they wade through the water to get the treats that they want. There have been many cases where chimps were horrible swimmers. Their muscle density is too high. They'll end up in the water and they'll drown, and their compatriots will lose their mind and risk themselves sometimes to even pull their friend out of the water. They don't get anything out of that. It's the same kind of empathy that humans show to each other, and they're capable of it all the same. Experiments have shown that when you give chimpanzees, I think Franz de Waal has done this work, but I can't remember. When you give them tokens in a lab, right? Blue token means you get 5 grapes, red token means you get 3 grapes. But your friend, who's in the cage over, also gets 3 grapes. They will, even when no one's watching, pick the altruistic red token because they want to help their friend, right? And they do it just like humans. They do it even more often when there's an audience, when they can see their friends. They do it even more, say, oh, look how generous I am. You know, you definitely want to be kind to me and, you know, help me up the hierarchy. So they are like us, but more accurately, we are like them. That would be a more realistic way to put it. And to put a cap on that, Robert Sapolsky, famous primatologist, right? He does all this work with baboons. He put human behavior, he put animal behavior into 3 categories, right? There's the things that humans do that all other animals do, right? Classic things like eat, breathe, in the case of female mammals, going into estrus, competing for resources, things like that. There's the things that humans do that other animals do as well, but humans tweak it a little bit, right? Things like tool use and coalitionary support. And then there's the smallest pool of them all, and it's the things that humans do that are entirely unique. And the one thing that Robert Sapolsky could find to put into that, at least in the lecture that I listened to, is that humans are capable of empathizing across space and time. We can feel sad for a picture of a cartoon dog, right? It's not even real, and we're like, oh, that's such a little kid, that's so sad, you know? But at the same time, do we have the number of rods and cones that a mantis shrimp has? It can see 4 times the colors that we're capable of seeing, right? Or the speed and agility of some of our living relatives. It's like, no, we can't. We we've put all our eggs in one basket, and that's the intelligence basket. And it seems to have worked out fairly well for us and fairly poorly for everything else. But that is to say, we are in such a grand fashion, definitively and utterly tied to the rest of the tree of life. It is inescapable at every single level. And that is so cool.
Erica, talking to you has been so cool. You're one of my favorite. You're one of my new favorite primates.
I get a lot of creepy comments where they're like, "Ooh, I wish Erica would study me as a primate." And I'm like, "Thanks." There's a couple more keywords that I need to flag.
That's weird. Yeah, that's weird. Thanks so much for your time. It's really an education, and I think it's a wonderful example of how we don't have to be threatened by the natural world, but we can really get excited about understanding things as they really are. And your enthusiasm is contagious.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. It is my ultimate goal, my nefarious plot here in my shadowy cabal of evolutionists, you know, in our gothic castle to take down all the poor innocent creationists, is that I just want people to understand how amazing this truly is and to really feel just the widespread series of events from 3.8 billion years ago to now, just so we can sit here and have this conversation. And I don't understand. I can't get into the headspace where you can see that and not see the beauty and the grandeur in it. So
it's amazing, and it's been amazing talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. This was a blast.
Follow The Thinking Atheist on Facebook and Twitter for a complete archive of podcasts and videos, products like mugs and t-shirts featuring The Thinking Atheist logo, links to atheist pages and resources, and details on upcoming free thought events and conventions. Log on to our website, thethinkingatheist.com.